When you see a fully uniformed police officer standing guard outside, like a corporate bank or maybe a high-end retail store or a private VIP event, there is a very natural assumption we all make.
Right, you just see the uniform and assume it's normal police work.
Exactly. You see the badge, the firearm, that NYPD patch, and you just assume it is the city doing its public safety thing. You assume your tax dollars are paying them, and, well, you assume the city is legally responsible for whatever happens on that sidewalk.
Yeah, which makes total sense.
Yeah.
But today, we are taking a deep dive into a legal analysis by Eric Sanders that completely shatters those assumptions.
It really does. We are looking at a comprehensive breakdown of the NYPD paid detail program. And this is a system where private corporate vendors actually pay off-duty officers directly to provide uniform security work.
Right, and the documents we are analyzing today reveal an arrangement that is just incredibly complex, yet it somehow hides in plain sight.
Yeah, completely in the open.
I mean, it is marketed to the public simply as off-duty private security. But structurally, it is a system where private money is literally purchasing public authority.
And our mission for this deep dive is to unravel that hidden public-private policing structure. Because this isn't just a story about cops making a few extra bucks moonlighting on the weekends.
No, not at all.
This legal analysis maps out how this system creates massive, completely unresolved liability, labor, and civil rights risks. And these are tangible risks for you, the taxpayer, for the private vendors writing the checks, and honestly, for the officers themselves.
It creates this really fascinating legal paradox where the rules just completely change depending on who you ask or, what kind of lawsuit is being filed.
Okay, let's unpack this because functionally, they look like they are doing the exact same job as a security guard. You walk up to a jewelry store and someone in a uniform is checking receipts, maybe managing the line, keeping an eye on the door. It feels like a private security function.
It definitely feels that way. But legally, they occupy entirely different universes. Well, a standard private security guard acts solely through private property authority. They can observe a situation, they can ask you to leave their employer's private property. And if you refuse, their ultimate recourse is to just call the actual police.
Right, they can't just throw you in jail.
Exactly. But a uniformed NYPD officer, even one who is technically off duty and being paid directly by a private bank, they carry state authority. They bring the badge, the firearm, and crucially, that latent power to detain, arrest, and use force under what the law calls the color of law.
I try to think about this in terms of sports. It's like hiring a real, officially licensed NBA referee to officiate your private backyard basketball game.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Right. Like you might be paying them for the afternoon out of your own pocket and they are standing in your driveway. But if they decide to hand out an official NBA fine or a league suspension during that pickup game, their actual power to punish you doesn't come from you. It comes directly from the league.
Yeah, the mechanism there is completely identical. And the Supreme Court has weighed in on this concept heavily. Understanding their logic is really crucial here.
What did they say?
So, in the landmark case Monroe v. Pape, the court established exactly how Section 1983 liability works.
And just to clarify, Section 1983 is the federal statute that allows citizens to sue for civil rights violations, right?
Yep, exactly. So, the court essentially said that liability reaches the misuse of power that is possessed strictly by virtue of state law. If an individual is clothed with the authority of the state, their actions are held to that constitutional standard, regardless of the immediate circumstances.
Which means the constitutional standard doesn't just turn off because the officer is technically off the clock and, taking a check from a bank.
Right. And the courts have been very consistent on that point. There's another major case, West v. Atkins. That one dealt with a private physician working in a state prison.
Okay, so a private contractor.
Yeah, private doctor. And the court looked at the situation and said, look, the source of the paycheck is totally irrelevant. The doctor was treating state prisoners using state-granted access. Therefore, they were a state actor.
Wow. So the exact same logic applies to these off-duty officers.
Precisely. When a civilian on the street experiences an officer's command, a detention, or a use of force, they are experiencing governmental power. State action doesn't magically disappear just because the person exercising that state-conferred authority is being paid through a private contract.
Yep.
The power travels with the uniform.
But I mean, knowing all these constitutional risks, it makes you wonder how the NYPD pitched this to the city in the first place. Nobody just hands over a blank check for private policing, knowing that the city could be on the hook for massive civil rights violations.
They definitely didn't. They had to make some pretty big promises back in the 90s to get this rubber stamped.
Right. What did those promises look like?
If we look chronologically back to the foundation of the program, there is a document from 1998 that really set the stage. It is the Conflicts of Interest Board, or COIB, advisory opinion.
Okay.
The department often cites this document as the program's, like, official blessing. But when you read the actual text of the opinion, it was a highly conditional approval. It was based on very strict, specific representations made by the NYPD.
Yeah, looking at this 1998 COIB opinion, it really doesn't read like an unconditional green light. It looks more like the NYPD had to swear up and down that they would keep a super tight leash on this entire operation to prevent corruption.
The promises were extensive. The NYPD told the COIB that the department, not the vendors, would strictly administer the program.
Okay.
They assured the board that officers would be assigned based on a blind rotational list. The goal there was to prevent officers from developing regular, cozy relationships with specific private vendors.
So you couldn't just have your buddy guard your store every Friday.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The officers wouldn't get to pick their assignments. And the administrative fee charged to the vendors would strictly cover the unit's operational expenses. It wasn't supposed to function as a profit center for the city. It was presented to the ethics board as this heavily insulated, ethically pure program.
But reading between the lines of that original 1998 approval, you can see a massive trap being set. This dual status danger is baked right into the text.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the COIB was told that officers are private, independent contractors for the sake of their paychecks. But if that officer makes an arrest while on that private detail, their status instantly flips. They are suddenly treated as public employees performing an official police function, which means they are indemnified by the city.
Yeah, the pivot in status is in media way. The second law enforcement action is taken. And that indemnification doesn't just cover lawsuits. It actually includes physical injuries, too.
Wait, really?
Yeah. If an officer gets hurt during a legitimate law enforcement action while working one of these private paid details, it is administratively treated as a line of duty injury.
Here's where it gets really interesting. And this brings the financial risk right back to you, the listener. Think about the mechanics of this. A private luxury brand gets the immediate tangible benefit of having a uniformed cop deterring shoplifters at their store.
Right.
But if that cop tears a knee ligament tackling a suspect in their aisle, the private store doesn't pay for the long-term consequences. You and I, the taxpayers, cover the sick leave. We cover the potential disability claim. We might be paying that officer's tax-free disability pension for the next 30 years. Plus the cost of hiring and training a replacement officer for the actual police force.
It's wild. The accountability gap between the private benefit and the public cost is just staggering.
Yeah.
That 1998 CRIB opinion only answered a very narrow ethics question under Chapter 68 of the city charter.
Just conflicts of interest.
Right, just conflicts of interest. It entirely failed to audit the long-term pension consequences, the disability exposure, or the massive municipal liability that the taxpayer is now quietly shouldering.
My immediate thought reading this was, okay, the city's lawyers aren't foolish. They clearly recognize this massive risk of placing public officers in private assignments. They didn't just cross their fingers and hope nobody got sued.
No, they definitely built a legal fortress to try to protect themselves.
Right. The source analysis points to the Bloomberg LP paid detail agreement as the prime example of how the city tries to protect its own wallet.
Yeah, when you transition from that foundational 1998 ethics opinion to the actual legal contracts used today, you see an absolute masterclass in liability transfer.
What does that look like?
The city knows the risk is immense. So the Bloomberg contract requires the private vendor to comprehensively indemnify and hold harmless the NYPD and the city for judgments, legal fees, and damages.
So they basically make the private company sign a piece of paper promising to fit the bill if someone sues the city over something the cop did while standing on their property.
Exactly. And the mechanics of the contract are highly specific. The private vendor has to provide defense counsel at their own expense. They have to coordinate settlements. And crucially, they are required to obtain commercial general liability insurance that specifically names the NYPD and the City of New York as additional insureds.
I want to pause on a really striking detail in that contract, because the city demands that this private insurance covers claims against the personnel in their official and individual capacities.
Yes.
If the city truly genuinely believes these officers are just independent contractors doing private security work, Why on earth do they mandate insurance for official capacity claims? I mean, you don't buy insurance for a house you don't own.
That is the crucial point.
Yeah.
The language in that contract is the ultimate admission by the city. By legally demanding coverage for official acts, the contract proves the city's liability sophistication.
They know exactly what they're doing.
They do. They are acknowledging in writing that the officer's public status, their state authority, travels with them into the private assignment. They know the courts will view these officers as state actors under Monroe v. Pape, so they built a risk transfer instrument to make the vendor pay for it.
But insurance isn't a magical force field. We all know how insurance companies operate. They look for reasons not to pay.
Always.
So what happens when that carefully crafted contractual shield drops? Let's say an officer uses excessive force on a private detail. The victim sues. The insurance company looks at the policy, points to an intentional act exclusion, and denies the claim. Or the vendor forgets to notify the insurer in time, triggering a late notice defense.
Or, worst case scenario, the private vendor just goes completely bankrupt.
Exactly. What happens then?
Well, when any of those failure points occur, when that private insurance safety net breaks, the liability falls right back onto the public purse. Yeah. A piece of paper transferring risk does not eliminate the actual constitutional harm to the public, and it definitely doesn't stop the courts from seeking damages. If the vendor can't pay, the taxpayer becomes the ultimate involuntary underwriter for this entire private security arrangement.
We've spent a lot of time looking at how the city legally protects its own wallet, but we really need to pivot to the officers actually working these details. Because this dual status contradiction doesn't just mess with liability. It creates a bizarre, contradictory labor structure that leaves the officers completely exposed.
Oh, the labor architecture is completely fractured. For tax purposes, the city treats the officer as a private worker. When tax season rolls around, the officer receives a 1099 form from the vendor.
So they're officially classified as an independent contractor.
Exactly. But operationally, on the ground, they are treated as a highly controlled public employee.
And this friction actually resulted in federal litigation, right? In a case called Pierre v. City of New York. The court looked at this setup and found plausible allegations that these private vendors actually function as joint employers of the officers under the Fair Labor Standards Act, or FLSA, and the New York labor law.
Yeah, that was a huge moment. The logic of the court there is that labor law looks at economic reality, not just the technical label slapped on a tax form. When you analyze the functional day-to-day control in the paid detail program, it is just a hybrid mess that traps the worker.
To ground this in something we all interact with, imagine signing up for a gig economy app, like a rideshare service.
Okay, good analogy.
The app company, in this case the NYPD, tells you exactly what uniform to wear, inspects your equipment, routes your pay, limits how many hours you can drive, and holds the power to suspend your account.
But the passenger in the back seat, who represents the private vendor here, they get to dictate your brake schedule, tell you exactly where to park, and can secretly complain to the app to ensure you are permanently banned from ever driving again. Who is your actual boss in that scenario?
Right. In your rideshare scenario, the driver is caught in a massive tug of war. And the exact same is true for these officers.
It's crazy.
It is. The NYPD maintains overarching authority, approving the vendors, mandating the official uniforms and radios, and retaining ultimate disciplinary power. Yet the private vendors are dictating the granular details, the exact work locations, the specific post instructions, the brake policies.
And the vendor decides if they can come back.
Most importantly, yes. The vendor retains the power to decide whether a specific officer is allowed back on their site to earn that extra income. And that brings us to the most alarming part of this analysis. That fractured labor architecture doesn't just create technical wage disputes about overtime.
Uh-huh.
It creates a massive, dangerous blind spot for civil rights.
It really does.
Because if a private vendor has the practical power to dictate work conditions or to quietly ban an officer from returning to a lucrative assignment, what happens if that power is used discriminatorily?
The lack of transparency in this specific area is just a severe governance defect. In a standard, traditional employment scenario, an employee's access to anti-discrimination protections under Title VII or the New York State and New York City human rights laws is clearly defined. But in this hybrid structure, the lines blur entirely. It leaves the officer without a clear path to recourse.
Let's paint a picture of what this actually looks like on the ground. Think about a 20-year veteran officer who gets pregnant. She's working a paid detail at a slick corporate bank lobby. She asks the bank manager if she can have a stool to sit on during her shift. The bank manager decides she doesn't look intimidating enough for their corporate image anymore and quietly tells the NYPD's paid detail unit to stop sending her to their site. Who does that officer sue?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. The NYPD says, well, we didn't discriminate against you, the bank did. The bank says, you don't work for us, you're an independent contractor for the NYPD. She's caught in a complete legal no-man's land.
The administrative silence on this is profound. If a corporate vendor exercises a preference based on race, sex, age, or disability accommodation, there is no clearly defined operational framework to handle it.
None at all.
None. Does the complaint go to the vendor's human resources department? Does it go to the NYPD's Internal Affairs Bureau? Or does it go directly to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission? The fact that the legal analysis shows no definitive answer to that question is a massive failure of the system.
The city essentially created a masterclass in financial indemnification with the Bloomberg contract to protect their money, but they utterly failed to build a comparable civil rights accountability framework for the people actually wearing the uniform.
Exactly.
And that lack of accountability extends directly to how the public interacts with these officers as well, because there are severe gaps in public reporting regarding what happens on these details.
The data tracking is virtually non-existent. Just as there is no separate operational framework for tracking vendor-driven discrimination against officers, there is no separate coding for police actions that occur specifically on paid details.
Wait, really?
Yeah. If a use of force incident happens, or a civilian alleges a false arrest, or a complaint is filed regarding an interaction at one of these private corporate sites, It isn't specifically flagged as a paid detail incident in the system. It simply vanishes into the general pool of NYPD statistics.
Which means we, the public, can't even study the true cost or risk of the program.
Nope.
We don't know if certain vendors or certain corporate environments are generating disproportionate rates of use of force incidents because the data is effectively buried. We are just flying blind.
We really are.
Yeah.
The overarching lesson from these documents is that you cannot privatize the funding of a police presence while simultaneously letting the public accountability for that presence fall through the cracks. It fundamentally undermines the system and leaves every single party exposed to profound risk.
So, bringing all of these threads together, the NYPD paid detail program is far more than just an administrative convenience or a simple moonlighting gig for off-duty cops. It is a dual-status legal minefield where private corporate money buys public police authority.
And every stakeholder is carrying hidden, unaudited risks. The taxpayer is quietly absorbing the long-term pension, disability, and municipal liability risks for when the vendor's private insurance inevitably fails.
Right.
And the private vendor is assuming massive, complex legal defense obligations that they likely don't fully comprehend when they sign up for a security guard.
And the officers themselves are left navigating a totally confusing joint employer structure. They are operating without clear civil rights protections, caught between a police department that treats them like employees and private vendors who treat them like disposable independent contractors.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We've talked extensively about liability, labor law, and civil rights. But think about the broader impact this structure has on the public's perception of justice itself.
What do you mean?
Well, if communities look around and see that highly visible uniformed police protection is quietly being allocated based on a private corporation's ability to pay a 10% administrative fee to the city, rather than being deployed based on a neighborhood's actual public safety needs, does that fundamentally erode the democratic legitimacy of the police force?
Wow, that is a chilling thought. And it absolutely changes how you look at the entire system. The next time you see that fully uniformed police officer standing guard outside the corporate bank or the luxury retailer, you now know exactly how incredibly murky the legal waters are beneath them. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden mechanics of the paid detail program. Keep questioning the hidden structures in the world around you, and we will catch you next time.